This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. New cultural arts director Beth Wisman makes a case for investing in arts programs and the Children's Discovery Museum.
How we celebrate the things that give us something positive or bright in the darkest times, that's the arts.
Wisman talks with GLT's Ryan Denham about the future of the Children's Museum and bringing together the pieces in Uptown Normal. It's another edition of Ask an Expert. With the help of ISU experts, we debunk myths about vegetarianism and protein and find out what two public radio reporters found out when they went digging into documents related to Legionnaires' disease outbreaks at a state-run veterans home. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's April 6th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. In just a few short years, the town of Normal has created several new landmark spaces in Uptown, starting with the Normal Theater and the Children's Discovery Museum, and Uptown Circle, too. But how do you make Uptown greater than the sum of its parts? That's the job in front of Beth Wisman, the new director of the Normal Cultural Arts Department and Children's Museum. Wisman is a former radio broadcaster who previously ran the McLean County Museum of History. She tells GLT's Ryan Denham that they're working on a more holistic approach to cultural arts in Uptown.
It is an exciting time. I'm trying my best to catch up on things that have changed since the last time I visited myself, getting to know the staff, getting to know the board, getting to know the rest of the departments within the town, and really just immersing myself in the Children's Discovery Museum, the Normal Theater, and the whole Uptown. It's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it is a lot. You oversee the town of Normal's cultural arts department. So that is the Children's Discovery Museum. That's the Normal Theater. That's a lot of things. So where are you spending most of your time and your attention so far after the first 38 days in the job?
Besides just getting to know staff throughout the department and throughout the town, most of the energy right now is figuring out my day-to-day and how I can split my attention to those things you just listed. A lot of it, I would say 70% of it, is the Children's Discovery Museum and the foundation that raises money for the exhibits inside the museum. And the rest are Normal Theater and Uptown events and activities. And the upside of that is the staff that we have is pretty amazing, so that equation makes sense. We couldn't do it without people like Adam Fox, for instance, who's doing a great job at the Normal Theater.
What are some of the goals that that the new city manager, Pam Reese, and the Normal Town Council have given you and tasked you with when it comes to running the museum and cultural arts in general?
Well, you know, I came on board after the last director left, and that wasn't something that they were planning on, obviously. And I'm not sure she was planning on it until it happened. And so some things were in the middle of transition and planning. So I'm picking up where Shelley Burlingmeier left off, which was a really healthy place. She had a strategic plan looking forward to how the museum was going to move forward. But what the town has asked me to do is to take that and think about better development of our foundation and our relationship with the organization that essentially raises the money to build our exhibits and improve on our programs. And again, more flesh out that cultural arts department and what it actually means. So I've been spending a lot of time thinking about holistic approaches to how people spend time uptown. You know, we have really awesome landmarks and anchors, if you will, that draw people in. So the Children's Discovery Museum and the Normal Theater, the roundabout, you know, that now that spring is here, it's amazing just to sit in my office and look out the window and see how people are using this very small yet very engaging public space to celebrate, well, for a few days there, warmer weather. So, but the direction the town gave me essentially was we're on a good path. we need to stay on this path, but we just need to find better ways to seek out revenue, like all municipalities, and how to improve our relationships in the community so that we continue to deliver good educational programs to our schools, to our homeschools, and to our visitors, and just think, you know, the vision of where we go in the next 10 years.
Full disclosure, when I'm not on the radio, I'm probably at the museum. I have two kids under the age of five. We're there all the time. And the exhibits themselves are in pretty good shape. You know, you wander around. But I'm sure there's an itch to add new things to it. A lot of the exhibits there have been there for a few years. Where do you see opportunities and needs to make physical changes to exhibits themselves within the museum?
When the town and the foundation partnered up over 13 years ago, the foundation raised over $3 million to build all of the core exhibits. Many of them are still there in the building, which speaks to their high-quality structure because over a million kids have played with those things, and they still have a lot of life left in them. When I walk through, I see our newer things like My Big Backyard, which, you know, PNC, thank you very much for being such a good supporter of helping us fund that. But next door is a medical exhibit that has already gone through a couple of changes. We have a portion of it now that's been turned into this free space for building with the blue blocks, if you've been in the Imagination Playground, as we call it. That used to be part of a medical exhibit, and our medical exhibit is now essentially the south end of that space, and it's so loved. Kids love being in there. The dentist chair, doing the operation board, watching the skeleton on the bicycle, making hearing your drum, your heartbeat through the drum. All of those things are really fun, and the kids play with it really hard. And it is one of our original exhibits, and so it probably needs the most attention. Luckily, again, it was really well made, and our doctors in concert over the years, that event has raised money to buy things, to make repairs, to enhance it, and we have done that very well, but I think we're reaching the point now where we need to start getting serious about where that space goes next. And it would be a medical exhibit, but how is it going to look? How are we going to pay for that? Those are things that we're really looking at right now.
What about the Ag-mazing exhibit, that agricultural-themed space on the second floor of the museum? I think your predecessor was working on some sort of fundraising campaign, maybe even toward the tail end of her tenure there at the museum. What is kind of the status of that fundraising campaign? Is that something you're going to continue or start anew in some way?
You know, it's interesting that that story got out into the community because there was a side conversation that was happening during one of the board meetings. And I don't know that the intention was to start a campaign per se just for that exhibit. I think it was acknowledging that that is an area that will need some attention, and that there are opportunities within the community for fundraising that are very interested in helping tell the story of agriculture to children. But at this point, it's not priority number one, because it still looks really good, and it was really well made, and it's not as old as the medical exhibit.
Some people may perceive the museum as being a strictly town-funded only operation. They see it as part of the Town of Normal, so they think, that's just, it's like a Parks and Rec thing. Town pays the whole bill. But if you wander around the museum, you see, plaques and signage all over the place that say, this is privately funded by so-and-so, and therefore. Can you talk a little bit more about kind of the role of private dollars in the museum's future? I mean, you yourself, you come from a fundraising background at the McLean County Museum of History.
Well, it's not unlike Illinois State University or WGLT or many other entities that have a public support system that is not its whole support, right? There has to be this other element of the community willing something to be. We want it. We're going to pay for it beyond what traditionally has funded something. So when the Children's Discovery Museum was looking to grow over a decade ago, they shopped around. They talked with the City of Bloomington. They talked with the Airport Authority. They talked with the Town of Normal, County of McLean. Where could we grow? Where would it make sense? And so the Town of Normal said, yes, we think you could grow here, and we'd like you to be the centerpiece of our new uptown. At the time, it was downtown. And so the town said, what if we built the building and we took on the staffing cost? What would that mean for the foundation? And they said, it would be awesome. It means that we could focus on the exhibits in the heart of the museum. And that's what they did. And they raised over $3 million at the time to build the exhibits and buy the furniture and pretty much turn that building from a shell into what it is today. So it is not just town-owned and operated. The town is the biggest benefactor, if you will, for the Children's Discovery Museum. But the foundation still remains the heart and soul of what makes it special. And we're lucky to have the town and have them take on that major cost of building the building, keeping it operating, and paying the staff. The staff is a huge cost, but of course that's what you need to operate a facility and have it open the way it is and have it operate at the high level that people have come to expect. So it's a partnership. It absolutely is. And we need the philanthropy and the sponsorships and the grants to keep that other piece of the museum working.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Beth Wissman, the new director of Normal's Cultural Arts Department and the Children's Discovery Museum in Uptown Normal. Well, let's pivot to the other side of your job, the cultural arts. The Uptown Normal area has seen a lot of new things related to the arts in the last few years, from Make Music Normal, the Uptown Circle music performances, even the opening of the University Gallery space just kind of down the street from where you are. So what about the cultural arts part of the job interested you as you were kind of going through the process of getting this job?
I've been a fan of the Normal Theater since almost the day I moved to town. You can't miss it. The idea that it has a whole new life. Film is still the number one draw for the Normal Theater by far, but it has other uses and other elements that kind of add to the quality of the Uptown experience, the appeal, you know, just even the photo op itself, you know, of the marquee is so cool, especially for Route 66 traffic that's coming through the community. That's a great stop-off place for that. But what interested me was being something bigger. The Children's Discovery Museum is a landmark, is a destination for the Uptown. The Normal Theater is in itself a destination and a landmark, but how do we take these pieces and bring them together as this whole that it becomes an Uptown destination beyond just retail, just entertainment, just education? It's bigger than that, and it's reflective of our larger community and what we want to invest in, what we value, and how we can work together with private and public to make something successful. And the idea that the arts and that culture, humanities, and science can make that happen, it's really exciting. And not even knowing exactly how it's going to work into the future, right? That's also really exciting. I don't want all the answers. Why are we here if we know all the answers, right? There are partnerships yet to be explored. There are events that can grow that we're really excited about. And there are probably events we don't even know about yet that could come to life in the next few years simply because we're willing to approach it this way and think about it in that holistic way.
Yeah, and you mentioned that word holistic a couple times now. What is an example of something that is maybe taking advantage of this holistic approach to the pieces that you have in front of you?
Sure. I mean, there are several of them. So you look at Make Music Normal. That's probably our most recent addition. And we do math and music education at the Children's Museum. We go into the plaza, the newly named Mark R. Peterson Plaza. We do activities outside to engage people from the museum's perspective, but we also are working with the Normal Theater. We're working with other venues that we essentially create, you know, not just the roundabout, but other stages that Adam Fox is helping design and bring together to make that Uptown space this participatory musical experience that also brings in retail and also brings in just an awareness of this space in our community and how we can use it very differently with all of those entities still involved. So that's been a huge success. It's only going to keep growing this year. It seems like all of the vendors we've talked to, the retailers, and of course the main landmarks that are participating are doing it bigger and better.
The Normal Town Council and town administration generally have historically been pretty supportive of the arts. I think that's safe to say.
Yes.
I mean, were that to change, though, in future iterations of the council or even just in a tougher budget environment like the town of Normal is already facing at this point, how would you make that case for the value of the arts?
My argument for the town and for the public is, you know, how we celebrate the things that make us unique, the things that give us something positive or bright in the darkest times. That's the arts. And whether that's theater or music or performance, dance, whether that's art in the most traditional sense of viewing or in learning, that's important and it's valuable. And we're not going to ever be the entity that funds the arts as a community. The town is never going to be that. But it can certainly use its resources to enhance, you know, the infrastructure, for instance, the Children's Discovery Museum, the Normal Theater, the Uptown, in the best way possible. It draws in, we have 140,000 people a year who come through the Children's Discovery Museum. They're experiencing art and culture when they do that. We know that there are, I forget what the number is, but it's something like 40,000 people a year who are traveling Route 66 from around the world who, yes, are going to land in Uptown Normal because I'm going to make sure they do. because the town's invested in heritage tourism, which is part of arts and culture, through the Sprague Station on Route 66. There are economic reasons that make sense. There are philosophical reasons that make sense. And there are, to use the word again, holistic health reasons to invest in these things. This is what makes us normal. And without the very things we've been listing today, we could be any town USA.
Do you think that Uptown Normal needs another performance space of some kind of a home for indoor live music and performances? The Normal Theater has a stage.
It does.
But it's not huge, and there's not much of like a backstage.
Challenges.
It has challenges.
It does. So do you think... do a lot with the place, though. We really do.
Yeah. You've got the Vaudeville Mondays. You've got a lot going on there. Is there a need or an opportunity for maybe a larger live performance indoor space in Uptown Normal?
Well, I would sure love to see that, but I don't think it's going to come from the public sector. That's going to have to be driven by the private sector or some serious effort for fundraising. It's not on my immediate radar by any means, but especially when you start talking about restaurants and bars and hotels and again, adding to that larger picture of what the Uptown is, performance space draws crowds. It draws foot traffic and people and business. So that would be lovely. I would love to see it. And I would go a step further to say I would love to see a collaborative performance space. We have some opportunities that are out there as we're looking at what's going on with the plaza, as we're looking at what happens with Trail East, you know, and what's happening on the other side of that. Who knows what developers would consider down the road? Again, nothing on the immediate radar, but I'd love to see that. I just don't think it's in the cards right now, and I think it's going to take private money to get it done.
That's Beth Wissman, the new director of Normal's Cultural Arts Department and the Children's Discovery Museum in Uptown Normal. I'm Ryan Denham.
The annual Doctors in Concert is coming up tomorrow night from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at the Doubletree in Bloomington. It's a fundraiser for the Children's Discovery Museum. Find listings for theater, concerts, movies, and more on the community page of WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Children's Discovery Museum Foundation, presenting the 13th Annual Doctors in Concert Fundraiser, Saturday, April 7th, featuring musical talents of local physicians, hors d'oeuvres, cocktails, and a silent auction. Tickets at childrensdiscoverymuseum.net. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, it's another edition of Ask an Expert. Find out if vegetarians are getting enough protein in their diets. That's still to come during Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. A box filled with hundreds of pages of printed emails recently showed up at the offices of some Illinois legislators. Those lawmakers sat on a committee that's been investigating how Republican Governor Bruce Rauner's administration handled multiple Legionnaires' disease outbreaks at a state-run veterans home. But more than half the pages they got were blacked out. And the lawmakers say the lack of transparency makes their investigation more difficult. Nonetheless, IPR's Dave McKinney and Tony Arnold have obtained some of the information from the governor's office, information the governor's office doesn't want lawmakers to see. They talked with Melba Lara, who started by asking Tony about their reporting process.
Well, lawmakers are trying to get information on how the administration handled these outbreaks, which have contributed to the deaths of 13 people since 2015. So they asked for the internal emails, but what they got were these heavily blacked out emails by Rauner's lawyers. But Dave and I have obtained some of these exact same emails in our reporting from the local public health department there in Quincy, in which hardly anything was blacked out. So it was a little bit of tedious work, but we were able to line up the blacked out emails next to the ones that we have, and we're able to put together at least some of what's been kept from lawmakers.
And Dave, I want to bring you in here. Tell us what you found. What was printed under the black ink that the state lawmakers received?
It's worth pointing out that the state can legally black out documents for a bunch of reasons. But the Reiner administration didn't originally explain why, for example, that they blacked out details about that original outbreak in 2015. Some of what we're talking about was, you know, whether the Legionnaires outbreak posed any special danger to children who were visiting a fenced-in park with deer and other wildlife on the Veteran Home campus, or whether the municipal water supply in Quincy was safe, or whether the staff at the home faced any special risks. And of course they did, because all told, 8 staffers wound up getting sick through last year. A lot of other blacked out information seems rather innocuous, but it's raising questions about why it was blacked out in the first place.
And let's talk about the legislators. How did they respond when you told them about all this?
The blacking out of these emails has been criticized from both Republican and Democratic lawmakers, albeit for very different reasons. Paul Schimpf is the ranking Republican state senator on the committee investigating the response to the outbreaks, and he says he's disappointed by the blacking out of this information because key information is lost. But he says also because the administration is preventing the public from seeing that they were being proactive at the time of the outbreak.
You want people to be willing to ask questions and have robust discussions without worrying whether or not they're going to be armchair quarterbacked in the media 3 years afterwards.
The flip side of that is Democrats say the blacked out emails raise more questions about what else has been redacted that we still can't see.
And Tony, has there been reaction from the Rauner administration about why they blacked out these emails?
Sure. We spoke with Patty Hsu. She's a spokeswoman for Governor Bruce Rauner. And, you know, she says that their offices acted within the scope of the law by doing this.
We're not trying to shield information that might make us look bad or make sure we pump out information that might make us look good.
And Patty Hsu also says the office was appropriate in what it blacked out because sometimes state workers need to talk through a policy. Sometimes they need to make drafts of things that will be released to the public. Sometimes those contain errors. They don't want those to be seen. And she says that the law allows for all of these redactions to occur.
So, Dave McKinney, the Rauner administration redacted a lot of the emails it gave over to lawmakers that are investigating the Quincy outbreaks. Why is it a big deal if they're actually allowed to do that?
Well, attorneys who have sued governments over a lack of transparency, they took a look at the side-by-side comparison and told us there was no legal reason for the redactions. One lawyer in particular, Terry Mutchler, handled thousands of disputed records requests as the former public access counselor for the Attorney General's office.
I think that this Freedom of Information Act response falls woefully short of the act and, candidly, of common sense.
I mean, this arguably adds another layer on top of how tightly the Rauner administration has controlled the flow of information about what it's labeled a public health crisis in Quincy.
You know, and I just add to that, that if you look at what Dave and I have reported on in the last few months, you can see that controlled flow of information. We first reported that the state waited 6 days to tell the public it had a Legionnaires epidemic on its hands. Later on last year, they publicly did not report an accurate number of people who got sick until we asked them. We also published another story about emails that show officials were particularly focused on public relations messaging as residents at the Veterans Home were dying during that 2015 outbreak. And, you know, the Veterans Affairs Department, the Public Health Department, they've rejected a lot of our attempts to see their Legionnaires-related emails, and these are the two agencies that are at the heart of it all.
That was WBEZ's Tony Arnold and Dave McKinney talking with IPR's Mel Ballara. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The number of babies being born with opioid withdrawal symptoms is rising across the U.S. Jacqueline Driscoll spoke with Crain's Chicago business healthcare reporter Kristen Schorsch, who looked into the stress it's causing both families and finances in Illinois.
Just seeing stories, some really haunting stories across the country about babies who were impacted by this because their mothers had used opioids legally or not, you know, while they were pregnant. And I wondered what that looked like in Illinois. So that's how I got started reporting on it. In terms of is it getting the attention it deserves, I think the story has been very widely read and widely shared, and I'm really appreciative of that. I think, though, the proof is going to be in the pudding in terms of if the state actually acts to address this issue. There is a state task force that is looking at what's called neonatal abstinence withdrawal or syndrome. I'm sorry, neonatal abstinence syndrome, and that's when babies are born suffering withdrawal symptoms. And their final report is due to state lawmakers next year. Whether the state lawmakers will act on it, whether they'll put any money behind this, shape some policies, I think we're just going to have to wait and see.
In your research, you found only 36% of counties have resources for treatment. How does this impact the opioid epidemic in Illinois?
Right. This is a pretty stark finding. So since the Medicaid program in Illinois covers nearly two-thirds of babies born with withdrawal symptoms here, the Illinois Department of Public Health tried to find out, okay, where are the opioid treatment options available for pregnant women on Medicaid here? And so what they found after doing a lot of digging is that only 36% of counties have some resource. So when you think about that, this is a big problem, obviously, not only because that's a very low percentage, but a woman who is pregnant and on opioids, and what really anyone who is addicted to opioids and is using methadone, for example, which is considered a gold standard of treatment, to wean themselves off heroin, for example, you typically have to take methadone every day. So imagine if you live in southern or western Illinois, there are huge swaths of treatment deserts, and you have to drive, you know, how many miles or hours to be able to get treatment. That's going to be really hard for people to maintain their sobriety. And so that's obviously going to be a huge issue for women.
What did you find most interesting or maybe possibly shocking in your research for this article?
It was really hard to get the full picture of what this looks like. Not every doctor in the state tests for neonatal abstinence syndrome. Some doctors, I understand, might only test babies whose moms are on Medicaid rather than wealthier people on private insurance. They might get some pushback from those moms. So then the state public health department and the federal government, they track or gather data on neonatal abstinence syndrome differently. And the data is old. I mean, the only federal data that had a breakdown of by state, where is this happening, Illinois compared to Ohio compared to West Virginia, is from 2014. So the opioid crisis is moving really rapidly. And for this particular piece of it, you know, trying to understand how it's impacting babies, it's really hard to get the full picture when you have old data and no really uniformity to collecting it.
IPR's Jacqueline Driscoll speaking with Crane's Chicago Business healthcare reporter, Kristen Schorsch. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Breaking news for all you meat eaters out there. It's time to mix up your diet. On this edition of Ask an Expert, we're debunking myths about vegetarians and protein with some help from faculty and staff at Illinois State University's Redbird Scholar Research Magazine. GLT's Ryan Denham has more.
A couple of times a year, we bring in Kevin Brissett into the studio. He's the editor of Illinois State University's Redbird Scholar Magazine. Thanks for coming in today, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Every issue, you've got this feature called Ask an Expert, where you take questions from readers and then find an ISU expert to explain the answer in human English. So one of the questions in the March issue of Redbird Scholar is a good one. It's about vegetarians and meat eaters. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, this one came from Deja Witt, a student, a senior from Calumet Park. She had heard that there is more protein in a plant-based diet than the traditional carnivorous diet, and she was wondering if there's any health benefits associated with eating meat.
So who did you turn to for the answer on this one and why?
This is Jennifer Barnes, assistant professor at the Department of Family and Consumer Sciences, and she is a specialist in dietetics, so we talked to her about it.
Well, the first thing that struck me about this question was that it was framed in a slightly different way than I'm used to hearing it. Usually I hear people that are concerned about not getting enough protein on a plant-based diet, but the fact of the matter is you can get enough protein whether you consume an animal-based diet, a plant-based diet, or certainly a mix of the two, which is the most common. So proteins are made up of smaller units called amino acids, some of which our body can make, we call those non-essential amino acids, and others that our body is are incapable of making. Those are the essential amino acids. So in addition to getting enough total protein, the other concern is that we get all of those essential amino acids and in the correct balance. Since our body can't make them, we need to supply them. Animal-based proteins are very good sources of those essential amino acids and in the right balance. So it would make sense that the composition of an animal-based protein is going to very similarly match the composition of our own body as far as the essential amino acid profile goes. Plant-based proteins don't have quite the same quality of essential amino acids that they're composed of. So what that means, if we choose to do a plant-based diet, we need to make sure we mix and match our protein sources from those plants to make sure we're getting all of the essential amino acids. That's called complementing your proteins. So it's a very common practice among people that choose a plant-based diet and are also pretty well educated about how to do it right. They're complementing their proteins. So you can live a very healthy lifestyle whether you choose to get your protein from plant and or animal-based sources. And there are some advantages and disadvantages to whichever way you choose. Plant-based proteins, they're a little bit more expensive, but they're also that complete protein with all the essential amino acids. They also have micronutrients that we need, such as iron and vitamin B12. Those are much more enriched in the animal-based sources. Another caveat to the animal-based sources, though, is that they also tend to be higher in saturated fat. And we know that saturated fat, we want to try to limit that in our diet to promote overall heart health. Plant-based, they have some advantages and disadvantages, too. So we already talked about the amino acid profile and how you need to make sure that you complement your plant-based sources. But plants are cheaper, for sure. They also are good sources of folate, potassium, dietary fiber, and they're also easier on the environment. You know, it's easier for us and more economical to produce plant-based sources of protein than it is animal-based sources. So really, you can do either one well. The overall trend in the nutrition community is to encourage people to increase their plant-based sources of protein. They're seeing correlations with lower risk of chronic diseases when people focus more on plant-based proteins rather than animal-based proteins. But that being said, either in moderation should be fine.
So this has been sort of framed as a sort of a false choice, right? You can be a vegetarian, but you're not going to be getting as much protein that way. It's really not an either-or scenario.
Right. So that's definitely not true. Those people that are conscientious about their protein intake and choose to be vegetarians do just fine. And in the U.S., where we have access to lots of different kinds of foods, it's usually pretty tough to find somebody that's actually deficient in protein.
I'm a meat eater, a carnivore, as Deja would put it. My wife is a vegetarian. So you're saying I should consider substituting in some plants protein every now and then, you know, on top of what I'm already doing?
You absolutely should. I would argue that that will decrease your risk for cardiovascular disease, colon cancer, especially if you're a fan of a lot of the cured meats. We really get ourselves into trouble there. You'll probably save a little bit of money and there will be less environmental impact.
All right, Kevin Brissett, editor of Redbird Scholar magazine. If folks are listening to this and they want to hear more, read more from the new issue of Redbird Scholar, where do they go?
All our stories are online at illinoisstate.edu, Redbird Scholar. And if you want to keep up with research at ISU between issues, you can check us out on Twitter at ISU Research.
That's Kevin Brissett, editor of Redbird Scholar and Redbird Impact magazines. I'm Ryan Denham.
Find past installments of GLT's Ask an Expert featuring faculty experts from Illinois State University at our website, wglt.org. If you have a question you'd like an expert to answer, email it to news@wglt.org. It's Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Mike Thornton Agency, presenting The Capital Steps, Orange is the New Barack, at the BCPA, 3 o'clock Sunday, May 13th. Known for putting the mock in democracy, The Capital Steps bring tears of laughter through musical and political satire. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. In the wake of the Me Too movement, state lawmakers have tried to address sexual harassment in a variety of ways. IPR's Mary Cullen explores what's been done so far and what some are saying might be ahead.
I think that the state house culture has been a bit of a frat house culture for many years. There have been some important voices coming forward talking about how harassment has happened to them.
That's Carrie Lester. The former Associated Press and Daily Herald reporter recently published a book that features women in Illinois government who share accounts of sexual assault and harassment. Victims' rights advocate Denise Rothheimer made controversial sexual harassment claims against State Senator Ira Silverstein of Chicago.
We have the problem because there's no transparency or accountability of the elected officials. They are the fox in the hen house. They do as they wish.
The newly appointed legislative inspector general released Silverstein of all charges, calling his behavior unbecoming of a legislator, but not sexual harassment. Last fall, over 200 people signed a Me Too letter asserting they've seen sexual harassment within state government. Rothheimer says she was invited to a bar where she was told women are hit on and solicited for sex by lawmakers. In Lester's book, a female legislator talks about the same bar as a place where she witnessed forceful and rampant harassment. With the implementation of required training, task forces, and numerous proposed measures, politicians say they are working to combat the problem across party lines. State Senator Heather Staines says over the past several months, improvements have been made. For one, legislation passed last year filled a vacant position, someone to oversee filed claims of mistreatment. That role had been vacant for 3 years, while more than 20 time-sensitive sexual harassment claims stacked up. Here's Staines.
I think there's still more work to be done, though. I think the Inspector General needs the ability to actually publish if there's a finding. Only if there's a finding. If there's not, it shouldn't go public. But we don't have that ability right now.
The groundswell of attention has included a spotlight on Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan. He sponsored the legislation for lawmakers to undergo training. But the state's most powerful leader has also had to deal with allegations about some of his staff. Former Madigan campaign worker Elena Hampton came forward about harassment she claims she experienced from one of Madigan's aides. After she spoke with the Chicago Tribune, Madigan fired Kevin Quinn, brother of a Chicago alderman and someone who had worked for Madigan for 2 decades. Here's Hampton in that Tribune interview.
I was experiencing sexual harassment in the 13th Ward office, the Speaker's district office, and I came forward about it, not once, but twice, and I basically lost everything I worked for because some guy could not control himself.
Hampton is now suing Madigan's political organization for what she alleges was improper handling of the claims. Madigan called on some female Democratic leaders to form their own look into the party's handling of allegations. State Comptroller Susana Mendoza says the panel is working independently and won't take funding from the party. The House and Senate Task Forces on Sexual Harassment and Discrimination held a joint meeting last month where they heard from organizations like the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission Office of Legal Counsel. One topic addressed was the underreporting of harassment. Though the claims and reactions related to the Me Too movement have been numerous, former reporter and author Carrie Lester says this is just the tip of the iceberg.
The voices of women who have experienced this problem are getting louder and louder in Illinois, and I think we are at the point that it can't be ignored or brushed under the rug anymore.
A newly passed law requires Illinois police officers undergo trauma training and allows victims to have more time to report an assault. It's a change supporters like Polly Poskin, executive director of the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault, hope will drive up reporting numbers.
This groundswell of support that is out there for victims to come forward and to say, this happened to me, is hugely important because then survivors don't feel alone. And when you don't feel alone, you feel empowered and emboldened.
I'm Mary Cullen.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. It's Sound Ideas on GLT. Advocates for the ERA will head to Springfield next week to lobby for its ratification in the state. Mary Hansen sat down with Rachel Otwell, who has been covering the topic, to find out more about it and why some say it would further equal rights for women.
So, Rachel, my first question is, what is the ERA and what would it do?
The Equal Rights Amendment is a proposal for the United States Constitution. It's just a proposal at this point, has not passed. The language states, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex.
So the amendment has been around for decades now. Give us a little bit of the history.
So the amendment was first drafted in 1923 by Alice Paul, a famous suffragist. It didn't reach congressional approval, though, until 1972, when it did pass through Congress. Of course, the president at the time was Richard Nixon, who was a supporter. It had bipartisan support, and a lot of people thought it was just something that obviously would go ahead and pass, but it did not. 38 states needed to ratify it by 1982, at least based on a deadline set by Congress, and Illinois was one of the states that did not pass it by that time. The efforts continued. Nevada actually ratified it last year.
So you mentioned Illinois was not one of the states that had approved it. Where is the fight now? Where does Illinois fit in now?
This issue has been perennial in Illinois. There's for several years, it's come up in session as a resolution. It's unclear what would happen if Illinois even were, if enough states were to ratify it at this point, since the congressional deadline passed decades ago. But regardless, the effort is still going on. It's still being lobbied for. The sponsor of the current resolution that would pass it in Illinois is State Senator Heather Staines. She says she believes she has enough support in the Senate pass-through committee and hasn't been called yet for a vote. She thinks she has the support there. She says she's not so sure about the House. Here she is from a story I did last year about it.
So we're trying to focus on developing more support in the House for it. To get a supermajority in the House, we're going to have some Republican support. For some reason, this has become a partisan issue, which I'm working to try to stop that. I don't think there's a reason that it needs to be or should be that way, quite frankly.
So there's the potential for it to reach ratification, at least symbolically, by the end of this legislative session.
Why has it been so difficult to get this amendment ratified in Illinois?
So Phyllis Schlafly really deserves the bulk of the credit, I think, for that. She made Illinois really the kind of headquarters for her Stop ERA campaign. She was a founder of the Eagle Forum, which is still in existence and says that it promotes quote-unquote family values, things like anti-abortion, anti-gay marriage. Phyllis Schlafly passed away in 2016. In 2011, she spoke with NPR's Michelle Martin about her opposition to the ERA and one of the pillars, really, that it focused on. So here she is talking about that.
The typical classic law that is not sex neutral is the draft registration law. And we were still in the Vietnam War in 1972. I had sons and daughters about age 18. My daughters thought this was the craziest thing they ever heard. You're going to have a new amendment for women. And the first thing is they'll have to sign up for the draft like their brothers.
The contention that she sparked really seeped in to Illinois politics, and though it came close to reaching ratification by the deadline, it just failed to get the crucial amount of votes. Should also probably be mentioned that the Illinois Constitution already has similar language to the ERA. Obviously, the goal for ratification, though, is to have it be a federal amendment.
IPR's Rachel Otwell speaking with Mary Hansen about the Equal Rights Amendment and the battle to ratify it in Illinois. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. At a time when fake news is a term known by just about anyone paying attention to current events, journalism's importance in history is increasingly being questioned. For his book, released this year by the University of Illinois Press, Fred Carroll takes a look at Black Journalists and the Fight for Racial Justice in the 20th Century. That's the subtitle for his text, Race News, which includes accounts of people and papers in Illinois like the Chicago Defender. IPR's Rachel Otwell has this interview about him, about his book.
In Race News, I explore the political and professional evolution of Black journalism in the 20th century. And I do this by tracing the relationships at the commercial Black press. That would be your mainstream Black newspapers, such as the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, the Baltimore Afro-American. But the relationships that these types of newspapers have with a repressive federal government that is looking to either silence or marginalize the news that is coming from these journalists, a hostile white media that wants to deny them the credentials of professionalism, and then in particular, their sort of contentious relationship with an alternative Black press, right? And the alternative Black press would be in the 1920s, newspapers like Marcus Garvey's The Negro World, which has a black nationalist outlook, and A. Philip Randolph's The Messenger, which is has a socialist publication. And then in the 1960s would be your Black Power publications, which would include the Nation of Islam's Muhammad Speaks and the Black Panther Party's The Black Panther. And the reason why I'm tracing these narratives, particularly with the alternative black press, is to try to get a better sense of how the template for news writing shifts over time. And I think that that's important, because what happens is these newspapers are establishing the parameters of what's considered acceptable political discourse for Black America, and at some times in the mid-20th century, it is wider, and at other times, it is narrower.
Yeah, I think even as journalists, sometimes we think of the industry as something that's been placid, or it's always been objective, and we have a clear understanding of what that means. While, of course, editorial boards exist, and editors might have opinions that skew conservative, if for instance, we're talking about modern-day Chicago. But if you can talk about some of these divergent views that these papers were including, if you can talk a little bit more specifically, perhaps, about the Chicago Defender.
Okay. So what begins to happen, really right around the time of World War I and then going into World War II, what you start to see, particularly amongst the national newspapers, such as the Chicago Defender, you see them starting to appropriate the ideas that are kind of percolating in this alternative black press. And so out of the New Negro Movement, you sort of see them have a greater sort of racial militancy, a stronger denunciation of racism and segregation start to appear. Out of the Harlem Renaissance, you've sort of more of a modernist sensibility that's saying, you know, it's okay to have scandal splashed across the front page, that it's okay for African Americans to talk amongst themselves about the flaws in their community. And then you also start to see, particularly in the 1930s with the Great Depression and the New Deal's failure to deliver on promised aid to African Americans, you see this, you see more and more journalists kind of picking up the idea that maybe communists or socialists, at least their racially egalitarian ideas, are pointing a way forward. They're not communist, but they are picking and choosing what are those from those ideologies what they like, right? And so what you see in the Chicago Defender, for example, is that by the 1940s, they've got an extremely progressive editorial op-ed page where they are essentially sort of reiterating the cultural front critiques, and by cultural front, I mean sort of the common man critiques of the American political economy, criticisms of the capitalist economy, criticisms of our two-party political system. You're seeing those on the editorial page. And so, for example, W.E.B. Du Bois in the 1930s, leaves the NAACP and later begins to write for the Chicago Defender. And this is at a time where he's starting to have a greater appreciation for Marxism. George Padmore, a Pan-Africanist who lives in England, who has left the Communist Party, but still believes that people of color around the world have this connection because they're all being exploited by capitalism. And he's writing about these issues in the Chicago Defender. You have the Chicago Defender's foreign affairs columnist who goes by has the pen name John Robert Badger, but is actually his real name is John Pittman, and he's the editor of the West Coast Communist Party newspaper. And so it's a way for the Defender to sort of articulate a forward moving response to white supremacy at a time when the Republican Party is failing African Americans, the Democratic Party is failing African Americans. And during the Great Depression, they're suffering worse than any other group in America.
So the book covers the fact that a lot of these people came from philosophies that include anti-capitalism, anti-colonialism, and at times, black separatism. I was wondering if you could tell us also about somebody with an Illinois tie. Ethel Payne was born in Chicago in 1911, and she was a journalist and civil rights activist. She was known as the first lady of the black press.
Okay. Well, Ethel Payne, right, is of this generation of journalists that is a sort of coming of age during World War II, when there's this intense pressure on black journalists to sort of tone down their more staunch criticisms of the United States, of segregation and discrimination. But they can't do that really without losing their readership. And so they're walking this narrow thread where they are pronouncing their patriotism, but also pronouncing their disgust with segregation and discrimination. And so Ethel Payne is coming of age in that and then starts to work for the Defender in the 1950s. Well, she's going to have a new approach to these older writers who came of age in the 1930s and are responding to the Great Depression. And she is coming of an age professionally at a time in the 1950s when the anti-communism movement has caused newspaper publishers to rid themselves of known progressives. And the way that Ethel Payne approaches the news is to criticize, not so much to criticize communism, but criticize American segregationists for encouraging African Americans to look at communism, as well as other people of color around the world who begin to look to the Soviet Union as friends because of the discrimination that is present in America.
Fred Carroll talking about his book, Race News, released earlier this year by the University of Illinois Press. He spoke with IPR's Rachel Otwell. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews with help today from Ryan Denham and News Director Charlie Schlenker. You can also find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.